or of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. As you're no doubt aware, President Trump made enormous waves over the weekend with his latest series of tweets, this one involving professional athletes and the national anthem. Hardly a week goes by when 140-character messages by the president don't dominate the headlines.
But a new book by Wisconsin writer John Nichols makes the case that for every presidential tweet story, there is an equally important one involving other members of President Trump's administration. The book is called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, and Nichols, who is the national affairs writer for The Nation, joins us on the line from Madison. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure.
How would you want or maybe expect people to use this book?
I think people should use it in a number of ways. First off, I hope it's a good read. I mean, when you write a book, that's what you want. So it's got a lot of history as well as a lot of observation of the current moment. But beyond that, I think this book is called A Field Guide for a reason. It provides entries into a lot of areas of government that don't get much attention from major media, and that especially don't get much attention now, as Donald Trump seems to suck all the air out of the room. Every time he tweets, we pay attention to that. And it's not inappropriate to pay attention to Trump. But what I argue with this book is that beyond Donald Trump, beyond what he does on any given day, are all the people that he has given positions of immense power, both in running cabinet departments, but also in running regulatory agencies. And on a daily basis, no matter what Trump is doing, these people are actually implementing an agenda, a very aggressive agenda, that is transforming America.
Right. I gather that there is some real significance to the fact that with just a few exceptions, practically no one in this book is an elected official. What are we talking about in terms of the state of the executive branch?
Well, that's a very good question. One of the things that I recognized as I was writing this book is that Donald Trump is really sort of an early warning alarm about the vulnerabilities, maybe a late warning alarm about the vulnerabilities in the American political system. So his election certainly was an alarm as regards the Electoral College. People can choose where they want to go on that issue, but it told us the Electoral College can in fact make someone who has lost by a wide margin president of the United States. Similarly, once Trump came into power, as he went through his transition process, you saw him bring people into positions of immense authority. Really folks with the power to define whole sectors of the American economy, as well as our health care, our education, our environment, issues of war and peace. He brought folks in who were very much on the fringe, even of his own political party. And what you realize is that a president now who has a Congress that is aligned with him, at least a Senate that is aligned with him, really has the ability through appointments to fundamentally transform not just government, but how the United States functions. And we're seeing that play out. And really what I sought to do with the book was to point to how cabinet government and the regulatory state actually is very vulnerable to extreme political swings. And also, as an extension of that, that we are vulnerable.
How did you deal with the issue of the moving target, if you will? Knowing that as you're writing this book, some of the people in it would either be gone from the Trump administration or have more or less influence in the Trump administration.
Absolutely. One of the things I started out by doing was basically making a commitment that I would look at all the people that Donald Trump chose to empower as he came to the presidency. Because it's a very, very good signal about who he wants in what place and also who has influence in the broad sense, in the policy sense. This isn't just about personalities. This is about initiatives. It's about an approach to the environment, an approach to education, an approach to budget issues, whether you fund domestic programs or the Pentagon. And so I used many of these people that I look at as vehicles to look more deeply at the policy implications. So if someone, say a Sebastian Gorka, who is in the White House, gets bumped out or moves out of the White House, it doesn't really matter so much. The fact is that Donald Trump put this person there initially and, in fact, deferred to Gorka clearly on a number of issues. Now, the reality is that about 95% of the people I write about are in exactly the position that they were in, you know, at the start. There isn't really as much churn in the administration as people think. There have been some high-profile exits, like people like Steve Bannon. And one of the arguments I make as regards Bannon, I make it in the book and certainly have it in discussing it, is that Bannon always accepted the title of chief strategist. He's interested in the campaign, in the White House, and now as he's left the White House, in the strategies that surround Donald Trump to initiate a number of political projects. And I would suggest that understanding these people, understanding someone like Bannon, is important whether he is at the moment in the White House or on the edge of the White House seeking, with many of the same funders, with many of the same allies, to advance the same agenda. So the moving target thing didn't bother me too much.
Right, and I was going to ask about Steve Bannon. You would make the case that even out of the White House, even without the title of chief strategist, you know, even without any official ties to Donald Trump at this stage, he holds a certain amount of sway within the Trump sphere of influence.
My argument would be he is more powerful because of his close ties to Robert and Rebecca Mercer and other funders of very right-wing political projects. As he's left the White House, he's repositioned where he was before he came into the White House, and that is as a central figure on the very far right wing. Some say alt-right. I would say really just as on the far right wing of what we refer to as conservatism. It's actually a kind of a restructuring of conservatism. But the bottom line is, as Bannon says correctly, he, on the outside, has a unique ability to influence the administration by propping up Donald Trump, as he said he will do, but also by going after Donald Trump's critics and opponents, both in the Democratic Party but also in the Republican Party. So I think Bannon's influence is immense. And I would also note that when Donald Trump spoke at the UN the other day, the speech that he gave was written at least in part by Stephen Miller, who is still in the White House, very close associate of Bannon's, very close associate of Jeff Sessions, somebody who comes out of this same ideological circle. And so the influence doesn't shift just because, you know, you have one player on the board moved. It's quite obvious that the Bannon ideology, if you will, via Stephen Miller, is still very influential in the White House.
So putting aside Steve Bannon or Jeff Sessions or any of these other really high-profile people, who are some of the lesser-known officials you think we ought to be aware of?
Yeah, I think that Stephen Miller is a very good person to pay attention to. He's very young, 32 years old, really grew up on the far right, and brings all of the extremes, all of the ideas that Bannon has professed and that Bannon's been noted for, deep into the White House as somebody who's writing president's speeches, helped to write the inaugural speech, helped to write the UN speech, very active in the Muslim ban. He's a classic example. But there are other folks that we don't pay as much attention to. I always point to Elaine Chao. She is the wife of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. She's a veteran of Republican administrations and in many senses a classic Washington insider. And yet, as I write in the book, wherever she has gone, she has been very, very involved in restructuring the agency she heads to make it dramatically more corporate, dramatically more supportive of privatization. She has a very, very aggressive agenda. And why that agenda becomes incredibly important at this point is because the Department of Transportation that she heads is very likely to have a lot of influence as regards infrastructure. And if it is indeed a trillion-dollar infrastructure program, you have a person in charge of one of the key agencies who really doesn't even have an interest in the old FDR-type Civilian Conservation Corps, WPA infrastructure. This is something much more privatized, much more corporate, and frankly, much more costly. And so you need to know about her. Another example, Scott Pruitt over at the EPA. Many people are aware of him, but I'm not sure everyone's aware of how militantly critical he is of climate science and how he has used his position to undermine the work of scientists who warn us that we really are faced with an environmental catastrophe. And the final person I point to, although there's many, many
sure.
more, is Mick Mulvaney at the Office of Management and Budget. Mulvaney was in the House of Representatives. He was so far to the fringe that he was really thought of as sort of the top advocate for shutting down the federal government. Now he oversees budget issues. Why that is significant is that his budget proposals, which are very influential, and actually some of which have even started to get some traction in Congress, his budget proposals invariably default to an idea of downsizing domestic programs in radical ways. He even attacks Meals on Wheels programs as too costly or inefficient, and moving that money in the tens of billions, even the hundreds of billions, over to the Pentagon. And what I argue in the book is that this really is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about when, in his last speech as president, he spoke of a military-industrial complex, a situation where the military becomes so dominant that and this isn't to dislike the military, it's just to say the imbalance becomes so extreme that domestic programs suffer, and that, frankly, democracy itself is undermined by a loss of the ability via budgeting to define our domestic future.
I wanted to ask you about one other name that jumps out a little bit in terms of how he fits into the current Trumposphere. You count Paul Ryan among the so-called horsemen, and here's a guy who at some levels seems to have been at odds with the president, certainly from time to time. Where do you see him fitting in?
That's a very good question. Look, Paul Ryan is a man of government. He's been in Washington for the better part of more than a quarter century as an aide and now a member of Congress. He's clearly someone who would like to be the mainstream of the Republican Party, and has been so as its former vice presidential candidate. But what I point out with Ryan is that ever since Trump arrived on the scene, he has had an enabling relationship with Trump, despite the fact that much is made of his occasional disagreements with the president. What Ryan always does, going back to 2015, is grumble a little about what the president says, raise an objection, but then at the end of the grumbling, say, well, of course, if he's the Republican nominee, I'll back him, just as he now says, well, of course, I will work with him. And, instead of standing up to Trump and really restoring that system of checks and balances, I would argue that Paul Ryan has been very much an enabler of Donald Trump. And the tragedy of that is that Paul Ryan does know at least something about the legislative process. Donald Trump does not. And one of the reasons why we have so much dysfunction in Washington at this point is because Paul Ryan has deferred to Donald Trump on so many issues, on too many issues, rather than leading.
One of the curiosities of this presidency is the kind of open question of who really has the president's ear. And on one level, you can describe these people as having their hands on the levers of power. But how much do we really know about whose hands are the heaviest at this point?
Well, that's a very good question. But there's an answer to it that may surprise folks. It's quite clear that going in, Donald Trump knew very, very little about cabinet government and very, very little about the regulatory agencies. I doubt he could have named them all, and frankly, I doubt most Americans could. But he really wasn't prepared to oversee these agencies, to oversee the people that he appointed. And in many cases, they are moving on their agendas, whether they talk to Trump on a daily basis or not. You look at Scott Pruitt at the EPA. His restructuring the EPA is moving at an incredibly fast rate and really putting it at odds with many of the environmental agendas and ideals that were core to its founding. Similarly, over at Justice, it is true that Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions, once very close, now grumble at each other and don't always get along. But Jeff Sessions is rolling straight forward over at the Department of Justice, radically changing the policies of the United States on civil rights, voting rights, and a host of other issues. So one thing to understand is once these people are empowered, because Trump himself is not a detail man and does not have, by most measures, a long attention span, these people are moving on the basis of the power they've been given. Now, within the inner circle of the White House, I think that it is a constantly revolving reality. But one thing I'll remind people of, when Donald Trump goes to give a major speech, it's very often that Stephen Miller, it's very often that Trump defers to him. The other person who I think is quite influential still is Gary Cohen over on the economic side. I do think that Trump listens to him quite a bit, and Cohen is extending that sort of Goldman Sachs economics in the White House. But, you know, as I write about all these people, one of the things that becomes very, very clear is that on any given day, if you're in that West Wing, your stature may rise or fall, but it's never constant. Many people thought that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner would be guiding a lot of things at the White House. It's now quite clear that on issue after issue, their counsel may be taken, but it's not followed.
John Nichols, it's really interesting reading. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
Wisconsin writer John Nichols is a writer for The Nation magazine, and he's the author of the new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. He'll talk about it Wednesday night at Boswell Book Company.